Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and today I have with me Annie Sclaver-Orenstein. She is a cultural researcher, writer, and storyteller who spent over a decade conducting in-depth qualitative research with thousands of people around the globe on behalf of brands from Viacom to Crayola, Twitter, Netflix, Instagram, Pfizer, and many more. She's the author of the book, Always a Sibling, The Forgotten Mourner's Guide to Grief. Welcome to the podcast, Annie. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. You're coming to us from Connecticut.
I am.
Which is also
hot and humid.
Yes. I don't know.
I'm coming from my air-conditioned office.
Oh, that's so amazing. Well, so I'm gonna win because I have to turn off the AC because it's so loud in my room. So I will likely be sweating by the time we're done. But that's
I would pass out.
I had to come to this room, and that's what happens in this room. But so before we dive into your book and your story, can you tell us a little bit about your cultural upbringing and background?
Of course. So yeah, I grew up in Connecticut, not too far from where I am now. And was raised Jewish, Reform, and kind of more culturally Jewish probably than anything else. And so lived with my parents and my two older brothers, who are 4 and 8 years older than me. So I was the youngest. And I lived in Connecticut through high school, and then left and lived in New York for about 20 years, in New York City for about 20 years, with a 3-year hiatus in LA and then back to New York. And we moved back to Connecticut in 2020 during COVID, as a lot of people did. And we've liked it and we stayed, and I certainly never thought I would move back to Connecticut. You know, I left at 18 and thought, yeah, I'm never coming back. And now here I am raising my kids, you know, 30 minutes from where I grew up.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, that is amazing. You went and did your big city time. You got to see all the big cities and then came back to home.
Yes. Yes.
That's awesome. Right. Okay. So do you know your Enneagram?
I do. I am a 2 and a 4.
You're a 2.
I'm a 2
that goes like, to 4 in strength.
Goes to 4.
Yeah. So you tested really high in both of those, which immediately made me think, oh, she's a 2, like she's likely a 2 that is really strong in growth in that side, in that aspect of you. And then I'm a 2 as well. And I feel like when we're in our 4, we're very playful and relaxed and enjoying the 5 senses. That's the best way I can describe it.
I like that.
Yeah, it feels like we just are really connected to all of our senses. And so we just experience the world through a genuine connection to others, but also to everything bigger than just ourselves.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, I want to focus on that and not where we go to in our stress point, which is the 8. 2s go to 8 in stress and can become very enlivened, passionate, angry. wanting to communicate what we might not have communicated clearly when we needed to.
That feels right too.
That does. Well, so what I've learned about you is after you lost your brother Ben, he was killed in Afghanistan by a suicide bomber. And you said that when you were grieving, you went to the local bookstore trying to find comfort and couldn't find any book that was about the loss you were experiencing as a sibling. And then here you are, how many years? That was 2009.
Almost 15.
15 years later, now writing the book that you wish that you had had and have released it. And I just think that is so incredibly powerful. And I was so excited to have you on. Tell us how you got to this place. Where did this start for you?
Yeah. So it didn't start where it ended. If that makes any sense, you know, when I started this process, if you had said that this was the book I was going to come out with, I would not have believed you emphatically. When it started, we were approaching the 10-year anniversary of Ben's death, and I missed him, and I wanted him. I wanted to feel his presence. You know, you get to a point after you've lost someone where you know, you don't get any new memories after someone dies, but there is a period where people are still sharing their memories with you. So you kind of get like secondhand new memories, and then that kind of stops. And I missed that, you know, I wanted a new memory, a new story. And I kept thinking about how being 8 years younger than him, you know, even though he was very open with me, there was still a lot I didn't know. You know, I wasn't alive in his early childhood. I didn't really know much about high school other than what he told me. And there were these other people in his life who had these stories. And so I started to talk to people in his life who knew a different part of him. You know, people who he served with in the military, people who were friends, you know, when he lived in Atlanta, people who, his high school best friends, you know, and I started to have these conversations, and I felt like I was getting pieces of him back. And I started to put together, you know, the idea for a book that was very much his story. And it was his, he was an avid journaler. And I have his journals. And so it was kind of his story as told from his journals and these interviews, almost like an oral history. And I started trying to shop around this idea. And I found an agent who I really liked. And at this point, I had written a piece for Time magazine. And she said, you know, I really like your writing, but this book is entirely about him. And I want you in this book. So would you put yourself in the book, you know? And so I put together a second version of the proposal that still followed him to some extent, but also followed me in those first few years. And again, we got feedback, and this time feedback from publishers, and that said, you know, we agree that there is an opportunity for a book about sibling loss, but can it be more prescriptive nonfiction about sibling loss rather than this more kind of narrative memoir?
Right.
And my first response was no, absolutely not. You know, I remember joking to my agent and saying, like, what, they think I'm going to write like 10 ways to get over your dead brother? Like, no, I'm not. That's a terrible idea. I think part of it was that I hadn't found a book like that I found really helpful. And so I couldn't really picture it, right? Because I hadn't seen that. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, like, well, that actually was the book that 25-year-old Annie went looking for when my brother died. I did want that. That's exactly the resource I wanted, and it didn't exist. And could I write the book you know, that I needed and that I still need because I'm still grieving. And so I took a few months and put a lot of thought behind what would that book look like. And then the book really took a turn, and it turned much more into the story of the siblings left behind and the story of the sibling relationship. You know, none of those initial interviews that I did are in the book. There's no, his journal entries are in there, but a few of them kind of sporadically. But it's interesting because those interviews that initially got me thinking are really nowhere in the final version. But I think I still needed to, I think I still needed to do that in a way for myself.
Yeah. Because it was what you were actually craving at that time was the memories. And then you got into it writing it. And as you heard from other people going, okay, you've got that. But what you needed at 25 is going to feel a little more prescriptive. And so it's like you got the best of both worlds. But I love that you were willing to shift it a little bit to be able to do that, because the book is so incredibly powerful in the writing of specifically to the siblings. Like, these are, this is for people who have experienced that loss. What were you missing in those early days? Like, what was it that you were experiencing from people that made you feel that forgotten mourner?
I was missing validation, validation and acknowledgement. You know, the sibling role and kind of this role of the forgotten mourner, it's little things, right? It's tiny things like someone asking how your parents are doing and not asking how you're doing, right? It's someone asking you questions that you know they would never ask your parents, right? Like details on the death or whatever follow-up questions, or expecting you to be able to do something that would not be asked of another family member. It's people saying, finding out you lost a sibling and their first response being, were you close? Right? Which is like a, are you, answer that question so I can determine if you're allowed to grieve. Right?
Right.
And you don't ask that. Like if you are widowed, no one asks a widow like, oh, were you and your husband close?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
That's not a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think so there are a lot of these questions and comments that make it feel like you're not just intrinsically allowed to grieve, right? Mm-hmm. There are qualifiers. First, we have to see how your parents are doing. We have to see how, if there's a surviving spouse or surviving children, or like, let's check on everyone else. Mm-hmm. And then let me assess what I think your relationship with them was like. And then I'll decide if you're allowed to grieve. And there are kind of all of these things that they all seem nice, right? Asking how your parents are doing is a very kind thing to ask. Yeah. But when it's all everyone's asking is, how are your parents doing, and not how are you doing, then you kind of just at some point internalize that, like, I guess I'm supposed to be fine.
Right.
I went to a bookstore. I went looking for a book on grief, and there was nothing on sibling grief. And so I assumed I was supposed to be fine. And that's how everyone else had been acting, like I was supposed to be fine. And I think, you know, I think I'm very lucky because my parents were very validating of my grief. And I have a surviving brother who I'm very close with, and we were, you know, so I think in my immediate family, I had that support and validation, and through the interviews and all the siblings I spoke to, you know, I can say for certainty that is not always the case. There are a lot of people whose parents don't even realize they're grieving. I spoke with two different people who said it was, you know, months after their sibling's death where they got a call from their parents, and their parents said, I'm really sorry. I just realized you're grieving too. How are you doing? Wow. And so it's certainly not a given. You know, I was very lucky, but I think you just get forgotten because, and you forget your own grief, right? Because you're watching your parents grieve a child, which is terrifying to watch. And you don't want to be a problem for them. You know, you don't want them to worry about you. You don't want to put anything else on their plate. So you want to act fine to help your parents. And then sometimes people get like a little too good at acting fine. You know, they really convince everyone they're fine. And then no one checks on them. No one asks how they're doing. You know, no one shows up with a pizza and just to spend time with them and to help. And so there are a lot of people who wake up years later and realize that they have never grieved their sibling and they don't really know where to go and where to start. And so I hope the value of the book is that it can help in any of those situations, whether it just happened or whether it happened, you know, decades ago. There's always kind of something to process and to think about with it. It doesn't leave you.
No, stays with you forever. What was your experience with that? Like, did you have a time where you kind of had to hide it for a while? And then there was this point where you realized consciously, oh, wow, I don't think I've been validated in this grief. When did that happen for you? Like, how long did that take?
I think I was lucky in that it was always validated in my family. But certainly, I mean, I was 25 years old in grad school, living in New York City. Like, my friends had no idea what to do with me. I had a few friends who had lost a parent. I knew one person who had lost a sibling because I had had one friend who died and I reached out to his sister. But other than that, I didn't really know anyone. And I think I felt like, I felt simultaneously like I was turning into the girl with the dead brother, but also it was the only thing on my mind all of the time. And so I didn't know how not to be the girl with the dead brother. And so I would just avoid social things, you know?
Yeah.
And things would make me upset that didn't make sense. Or I thought, right? Like, now I understand how trauma works. But like, one of the things I talk about in the book was when my brother died, the big movie was Avatar. Mm. And I would not go see it. Because there was a war and there was fighting. And I was like, absolutely. No. And everyone was like, but it's like not even real people. And they're in blue body paint. And like, what are you talking about? Right. Like, it was very much like, she's being dramatic. And so I just kind of stopped. There were a lot of little things like that, right? Where you just kind of stop trying. You're like, maybe I'll come out of this shell eventually. But I had a few very close friends who I could be honest with. And those were the friends who would come over and watch TV while I cried and would, you know, clean up my apartment because I hadn't put away my clothes in weeks. And my boyfriend who would, you know, stay on the phone with me until all hours of the night because I was having nightmares and I didn't want to fall asleep. But it was a year where I think I lost a lot of friends because I didn't feel like I could explain myself. I couldn't even explain why some of the things were happening that were happening. And so I just withdrew.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that so many people experience that. In grief, in loss. I had a woman reach out to me and ask, like, why after my divorce did all of my friends, like, why did they disappear? And it's like, there's so many answers. It's so incredibly nuanced, but a lot of it is both parties. Like, we can only share so much of what we're grieving in a set, like, you have to really feel safe and for someone to be able to be that vulnerable to express and to be authentically crying on the floor, crying on the phone, just sitting in disassociative, like, I just need to sit and watch a movie, you know, like, and do nothing and talk about nothing. And, But a lot of people, if they don't know how to offer support and think it and aren't sure how to even ask that question, how can I support you? As simple as that, then they bug out. Like their nervous system can't handle it. My nervous system certainly can't integrate you at this time. Like it just ends up not working in that time. And sometimes that even just compounds the grief because you are hopeful that people would remain, that they would be able to stay in that space, but not all can. So that's definitely that aspect of grief. And then you've got, like you mentioned, the not wanting to be in these social environments. You have the situation where your brother was killed because of his job, he's in the military. So yeah, a movie about military, I'm sure, would be very triggering. Because I'm sure there's so much that you're having to process even with that process. I heard from another podcast where you shared about an email that you got from someone that you felt like, oh, they finally got it. Someone got it. Tell us about that email.
That email, are we allowed to swear on this
podcast? Whatever you're comfortable with.
That email was just the F word over and over and over. Like, you know, a friend had just copy pasted, just the whole way down the page. And I was like, oh, finally, right? I don't need to form a sentence. I don't need to read a sentence. This is literally my internal monologue right now.
Right.
And in hindsight, I realized it was like the perfect email when you don't know what to say, right? Because you get a lot of emails of people trying to say the right thing, which is kind of code for like trying to say something helpful, but there's no way to be helpful, right? You can't, there's nothing you can say that is going to make me feel better. You can be helpful through acts of service, but you're not going to be able to make me feel better, right? And so all the emails that try to make you feel better oftentimes just make you feel worse, right? Because you're like, wait, but this is so much more than that. Like you can't, this doesn't help me. Right. Or you feel misunderstood or whatever it is. And this email was just like, no one was trying to fix anything. No one was trying to make me feel better. I didn't have to pretend to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, it was like an email of falling apart, which is what it felt like was happening. And it stuck with me because it was really the most helpful email I got. Was I just felt seen and I felt like understood.
Yeah, I love that moment.
Perfect.
Yeah, it is absolutely perfect. So what I also love about your background is research, which of course within the first few minutes of talking to you, I had to ask about, okay, is Brené Brown also your favorite researcher? And you said, yes. You quote her lots in the book. So you have this background in research with these amazing big tech companies. And then here it is that you get to use that background to then write a book about grief. Tell me what you researched. Tell me what you were finding.
Yeah. So when I decided to take the book in this other direction, I felt like my experience was extremely unique. I had, you know, my brother and I had a close relationship, positive attachment. We did not have a traumatic, you know, upbringing. And he, you know, was killed in active duty in the military, which elicits a much different response from community and from, you know, that kind of community support than a lot of other causes of death, right? Mm-hmm. The way you're treated if your person is killed in the military is different than if there was an extended illness or if there was an overdose or, you know, if there were mental health struggles. And so I knew that my story I couldn't just extrapolate what I experienced and make it broadly relevant to people. But I wanted this to be a book that people who had lost a sibling could find, and not only people who had lost a sibling to a military death. You know, I wanted it to be more broadly relatable. And so that was really what eventually changed my mind about it, was when I really thought, like, wait, I actually know how to do this. I can research this. And so I fielded a survey to surviving siblings, you know, people who had lost a sibling, and got about 350 responses, which was great. And then from that, I recruited about 40 siblings to talk to for these one-on-one in-depth interviews. And I was very mindful to talk to older siblings, you know, younger siblings, people who had had good relationships and bad relationships, had experienced all different causes of death at different ages, were different, you know, number of years out from the loss. Like, you should have seen the spreadsheet. It was a work of art.
You have a picture somewhere, I'm sure.
It will give me like nightmare flashbacks, but I do. And at the time, you know, through all of this, I was working full time. And so I would finish work and have dinner with my kids and then go back up and have an interview, you know, at night. And there are a few times where I would kind of take a day off and stack 4 interviews in a day. And it was a very intense, like, 3.5 weeks of conducting those interviews. And I went into it thinking, you know, this is going to be bad for my mental health. This is going to, like, I was prepared for this to really take me down. And it didn't. It was really validating that I was doing this, that this was needed, that this was valuable. You know, people were really, really happy. It feels like a weird word to use, but they were grateful to be able to talk about their loss and to be able to talk about their sibling. You know, in a lot of cases, they rarely get to talk about them anymore. And so it was a really beautiful series of conversations. And I spoke with some experts as well, some grief therapists, a sibling and family expert from academia, and really started to kind of piece it all together. And I did that because I really wanted to be able to talk about the impact that all of those things have on you as the griever. And so I wanted to get all of those different perspectives in. I'm sure there's still a lot of perspectives that probably aren't there, but, you know, I feel good knowing that the book is more than just my story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that it's other people's stories too. Like, you took that approach, which is exactly the reason why I wanted to do a podcast. It was that same motivation. Like, there is something powerful about hearing someone's story. And as much as I want to make grief an everyday conversation, I'm not going to get anywhere by just talking about grief. Like, hearing people's own perspectives and their own navigating it and how different it is for each person is incredibly validating, because somewhere along the way, even if you don't have the same experience, you recognize a process, you recognize grief. And then it's very, grief is universal. And it's like, we experience it differently, but we're all going to experience it. And so hearing people's stories is so incredibly powerful in helping that process of validating for ourselves. That I love that you did that. So you came up in the book, the outline of the book in processing part of grief, you have three-point process. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So the book is structured, there's kind of a framework that the book is structured around, and it's with, without, and within. And, you know, in a lot of my conversations, and even just my experience, you know, we talked about in the beginning, people saying, were you close, when they find out, right? It became clear to me very early on that the first thing we had to do was acknowledge that we had suffered a loss without any qualifiers, right? You have experienced a loss, and it is a significant loss. And that had to be the first thing. I was shocked at how many people would share their loss with me with qualifiers. Right. And I mean, even like my hairdresser who said to me that she had lost her sister also. And she said, but it was, you know, it was like totally different because she had suffered from addiction. And so we kind of always knew this would happen. So, you know, it's like, it's not as bad. Mm. And I was like, but you still lost your sister, right? She was like, yeah, well, that's still bad. Right. Like, yeah. And these are just conversations that were happening, like literally I'm getting my hair cut. And so it became clear that no one was going to be able to, I couldn't help anyone kind of process their grief if they weren't giving themselves permission to grieve yet. And if they hadn't really acknowledged that this was a significant loss. And so WIF really focuses on that. It focuses on the sibling relationship, good, bad, or indifferent. And the impact that siblings have on us developmentally, there's a lot of kind of science in there about the impact of siblings and that even if you didn't get along, they still have a big impact on you and losing them is still significant. And we talk about memories and the loss of those memories and all of that is really, that first section is really processing the relationship you had. And then part two without focuses on the that acute period of loss after the death when you are in deep grief. And it talks about the changing family dynamics. You know, there's a lot that's very unique to siblings. So around watching your parents grieve, the changing family dynamics, the anger, the guilt, the resentment, you know, all of those feelings. The depression, I mean, just the deep, deep sadness. Yeah. And then the third part within is about moving forward in this new world where they are not present. And how can you continue to, you know, first of all, kind of making the decision, like, is feeling their presence healthy and helpful for you? And if so, how can we continue to have those bonds and to feel their presence and how can you bring them into your day-to-day life? Or if it's not healthy to have those bonds, how do you kind of break those bonds and how can you move forward after something like that? And so that's really how the book is structured and the process that it goes through. But I also think it's written in such a way that depending on how far out you are or what's top of mind, you can kind of like dip in any of those areas.
Yeah. I mean, just something that beautifully simple of qualifiers, watching for qualifiers. I remember being the moment one of my therapists told me that I was doing that a lot. And another thing that was a tendency is the being able to talk about it with like no emotion, like to be able to say something in a setting where it just almost other people are just kind of jaw dropped and you're just kind of like, What? Like, yeah, that happened. You know, like the inability to kind of connect to, hold on, this is heavy. Like this is heavy even for them. But being able to recognize the qualifiers that we do when we're hurting and when we're experiencing something, the comparative suffering, I'm really good about doing that with others. Like I'll be able to say, oh, what I have isn't as bad as what they're going through. We all do that at some level. But yeah, when you hear other people do it, you're like, wait, don't do that.
Right. And I'm like, but how does your like comparative, like, yes, but at the same time, it's still your loss. Absolutely. Right. And you own it. And so whether, you know, people act like grief is like a resource, right? That needs, it's like, nope, your parents need all of that right now. No, actually, unfortunately, grief is unlimited and abundant. There is plenty for everyone and we're all allowed to grieve. Now, what I wouldn't want to do is demand that my parents, you know, ignore their own grief and only help me in mine. But I think that's like one of the really difficult things that I talk about a lot in the book is it's okay that we're grieving a lot and it's okay that our parents are grieving a lot. And unfortunately, what that means is that we can't help each other. Neither of us are in a position to be, you know, the primary support for the other one. And so that's really hard in families where you're used to being the primary support for one another. Yeah. And that's where a lot of families, I think, end up having a lot of issues are, you know, parents relying on their kids as their sole support, as if their kids aren't already grieving. And that's right. when the grief ends up getting put on the back burner. But we can all, you know, going back to my comment about people asking how your parents are doing, you know, I think the solve is still ask how my parents are doing, just also ask how I'm doing.
Right, right. Not that's to all. The exclusion right. of asking how it's they're doing.
Right. Exactly. It's fine to ask how my parents are doing. Just also ask how I'm doing. That's all. Yeah. You know, they are allowed to grieve as much as they need to grieve. Just acknowledge that there are other people grieving as well. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. You also mentioned the fact that people would ask you as a sibling for details in the very traumatic death of your brother, but that they wouldn't ask your parents, but felt that it was okay to ask you, like you also weren't experiencing PTSD from that experience, which is just, mm-hmm. I mean, I know I shouldn't be surprised, but it's just, it just is so gutting to know that somebody would ask.
I hadn't even really thought about it. I mean, people certainly asked me like details of what happened. And I hadn't even really thought about it until I was doing some of these interviews, and people who had experienced, you know, a traumatic loss where there was violence involved, or sometimes in the case of someone taking their own life, you know, and the siblings would say, like, people ask me how they did it, or they ask me, you know, these details about what happened, and they don't ask my parents. And I thought back and was like, yeah, you know what? That happened to me. Like, I hadn't even really thought about it. Yeah. But you get put in these positions where people will ask like what happened, and you tell them what happened. And some people just like drop it like a hot potato because they don't want to go anywhere near it. And other people kind of lean in closer, you know, and like curiosity gets the best of them. But again, I don't think people are asking the parent how it, like those details.
Right, right. There's like a automatic, out of decency, you wouldn't. But it's that
you want to know. I'm curious. Always, if I heard that someone died, you bet. The first thing I want to know is every single detail.
Right.
It's human nature,
it's our
right?
human nature. Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we should always be asking. We have to read the room.
Yeah, absolutely.
And try to Google it in secret.
Yeah. And what was the last part?
And try to Google it in secret, you know?
You're right.
Don't make me tell you, just go home, Google my brother's name, and you probably can find out as much as I have.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's some element of just like reading the room to it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I love about your background too, is you said that you grew up Jewish, although you felt that it was more culturally than maybe practice, but I know you had practice. So
There was practice.
Yes. So I'm curious because the nature of the podcast, one of the things I say in the intro is regardless of your faith, background, or practice, grief affects us all. But what I do find interesting and would love to see research around it, because I only know of one study that was saying the significance of having a faith practice period to being able to move through grief with without the deep depression and the higher risk of suicide. And one of the things that I know from the Jewish faith that I think is so fascinating is sitting Shiva. And I was hopeful that you would be able to help us understand how that process affected the grief process for you and what you learned or what that practice has taught you. And maybe just start with what is sitting Shiva for those that don't know.
Yeah. So sitting Shiva is a grief practice in the Jewish faith. So we don't embalm and we don't do anything open casket, but because we don't embalm, the funeral typically takes place very quickly after the death, often within, you know, 48 hours. The funeral, or 72 hours. It happens very, very quickly. And actually, I have to say, the army was really, you know, respectful of that, and returned Ben's body very quickly. And, you know, we were able to have a funeral very quickly. But so the funeral happens, you know, first. And then there is a period of Shiva, which is the period of, you know, that initial mourning that is the 7 days, the day of the funeral, and for 7 days. And at least my understanding, or is that it typically happens like in someone's home. I know sometimes it can be like, we had it, the first day was at the temple because there were so many people, and I think it would have just been too overwhelming to have people in our home. But you know, people come over, and they usually bring a tremendous amount of food, like more food than anyone could possibly eat, because that's what Jews do to try to make each other feel better. Is we bring a lot of food, and we sit together, and there's a prayer for the dead in Judaism, and typically, I'm afraid I'm not going to explain this totally right, but traditionally, you have to have a minyan to have a service, and a minyan is like 10 people. So you're really supposed to pray in a group. Mm-hmm. And so part of Shiva is to make sure you have enough people there that you can say this prayer for the dead. And so usually they're, you know, they'll say Shiva from this time to this time. We're planning to say the mortar's Kaddish around this time. So people try to be there for that. So you have a group of people to pray together, but it's also just a time where you all just kind of sit there, you know, and it sounds like a weird way to describe it, but that's what it felt like just kind of sat there, and a lot of people who we knew and loved and cared about came from very far away to just sit with us and feed us and, you know, be with us. And people, you know, would come and put out all the food, and they would clean up after. I mean, my mom, we certainly weren't doing any of that. It was just kind of handled. And it's just a time to be surrounded by your community and to be held by them, really. And I remember being very moved by who came, and at times being very surprised by who didn't come, you know, people who I thought would show up who didn't show up, which I think is all too common in grief. But, you know, more than that, like my boyfriend, who's now my husband, but he was in architecture school at the time. And I remember like a bunch of his classmates came from Boston, from, you know, 2.5 hours away. Wow. And I was shocked, but I was so moved. And, you know, there were a lot of people that just came to be with us and show their support. And it was a very sad time, but I think it would have been sadder if we had been sitting there alone.
Yeah. And it's 7 days.
Mm-hmm. Some people won't do that long or whatever, but I think we did seven. If we didn't do seven, we at least did five. Yeah. I think in the Torah it's seven, but sometimes people are like, that's a long time. Like, you can't always
put it this way.
Like, I can't.
I think that's across all faiths. Thank you, God, but we've got it from here. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, thank you, God. I got enough food by day two to exist for the next 5 years. I can't do this anymore. You know, there is some of that. But I if we didn't do it for seven, we did it for five. We did it for a while.
Yeah. I remember, and I wish I could remember the movie, because of course when I didn't have anything going through the grief process of losing my parents, and So movies were always instrumental. Still Magnolia is the first one that taught me how to grieve. Sally Field, good grief. I mean, gosh. I mean, she went through all of the emotions in that scene, and it just stuck with me. But I was like, it was the year after my mom died when I saw that movie. And that was my first introduction to like, okay, people can do that. Okay, we could grieve like that. But there was a movie, and I wish I could remember the name of it, where the whole movie is centered around them sitting Shiva. And it's a comedy, and I cannot, it or maybe it's part of the movie. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
And yes. Was,
and the whole process, you're gonna, I'm not gonna remember.
It's,
and they go out on the roof, like somebody goes out on a roof at one point.
It's like all the siblings. Is it the one with Jason Bateman?
I think so. It does. Like, and Jane Bateman. Fonda? Was Jane Fonda the mom? I'm saying that wrong. It's probably not Jane Fonda. Anyway.
I know what you're talking about. I know what you're talking
right,
about.
Like right after mm-hmm. we press stop, we'll get the and somebody right now knows it, and they're yelling the answer, and we can't hear it. So frustrating. But
this is where I leave you.
This is where I leave you.
Yes. And it is Jane Fonda.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Hey, mm-hmm. yay, brain. Okay. So, but I just remember that was my first exposure to the process of sitting Shiva. But what I was drawn to was the community of that, of the intentional, I'm going to take 7 days and we're mm-hmm. going to be present with the grief. Like you said, we're just going to sit with it. I didn't have that. And I longed for that. When I saw it, I was like, we could be sad for 7 days. Like that's, but yes, because that's what
and the other thing with Shiva is it's like really about being sad. Like you're supposed to cover all the mirrors in your house mm-hmm. because like you're just focused on being sad, yeah. right? Like you're not focused on what you look like or anything. It felt like such a blessing that like
yeah
I didn't have to look at myself.
You cover the mirror so you don't see what you look like. Yeah.
Yes, because it's like you can just focus on being sad. Yeah. Don't worry, and someone else is going to bring you food and they're going to cover the mirrors, and it did feel like a time where we were allowed to be sad. And I remember feeling at times like, okay, but I want to just be sad with my family right now. Yeah. Right. Like I just want to cuddle with my mom right now. And I can't do that because there are too many people here. But for the most part, it was cause it's not the whole day, you know, yeah. it's a time. Yeah. And then you can kick them out after. So yeah. there was like a good, I thought that was really good that it was like finite period, but yeah. it really just to be in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the concept of that, like even saying I can be sad for 7 days, there is a part of me that's like, that judges that. There's an immediate online of like, wait, that sounds terrible. But if you grow up with the idea that it's okay to be sad and actually be sad over the loss of someone, then it feels like balm. It feels like mm-hmm. for validation of an experience for those that don't get to, you know, in a American culture, but even just like, I know we talked about in the South, what brought this to mind is that somebody that I know that lost both their mom and their mother-in-law in 2 days recently. And and he was back, and he, you know, back at work within 2 or 3 days. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, please, you know, please promise me that you will take time to just be, because mm-hmm. you know, we're just, he's like, well, it, you know, in some ways it does feel good to have an out, but like you said, it wasn't all day, but it was 7 days consistent after the loss. That is like, that time is so valuable. I wish we all could incorporate Shiva.
I was gonna say, I'm remembering when I was in ninth grade, a dear friend's mother died, and she lived 2 hours away. I knew her because our parents grew up together, and we went out there for the funeral, and we went out there for Shiva, and she being at Shiva at least that day was not helpful for her. You know, it was too much. And she just wanted to be alone. But I was there, right? Like, part of Shiva is that everyone comes for everyone. And so we just sat outside together. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it would be really hard to be at Shiva if you didn't have anyone there. I think mm-hmm. it could feel really isolating. Like, if I didn't have my own friends at Shiva, and it was just me having to talk to my parents' friends or seeing my brother's best yeah. friends around, I think yeah. that would have been, I don't think it would have been as helpful
yeah.
as, you know, seeing my friends walk through the door and feeling like there was someone there to support me as well.
Right. Which is the power of that community of showing up mm-hmm. for people and learning how to mm-hmm. do that. Because that teaches you guys as teenagers was teaching you, this is what we do to grieve. Like, we yeah. show up for one another. We get there. We find a way, and we just are there. We just sit there with you and eat.
Yeah. Yes.
Amazing.
We sit, eat Kugel and Blintzes and
sounds and so amazing. Many edible
arrangements. We got so many edible arrangements.
Oh, really?
I don't know if that's still a thing, but we got so many. We started turning them away.
Oh, wow. Really? So you really, I mean,
you
I can't imagine
eat
that
so much cantaloupe.
Yeah. Well,
it was, yeah.
I always leave.
I remember being like, is there someone else you could bring this to?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
I think it's amazing. Well, in the South, we do the wake. I know you said that when you first heard about that, you're like, what?
Oh, it's scary.
Why are you looking at this person? Mm-hmm. It's such a cultural difference, because it really is. Like, I grew up, that's what we did. We had wakes both for my mom and for my dad. And you were like, why? Because I was told it's for closure. Like, that's what I grew up with, is that you have to go and observe the body or you won't have closure. I don't. And it was just like, mm-hmm. but at the time for me, I remember at my dad's wake, not wanting, I avoided it the whole night. I remember standing position where my peripheral vision could not look at him. Mm. And it was like at the end of the night, one of a mentor in my life came over and said, encouraged me, like, hey, I'll go walk up there with you, but let's go do that together. And I remember feeling a lot of resistance, and then afterwards being like, okay, I think I'm okay with that I did that. But the freedom to know mm-hmm. that you didn't have to, you obviously could, you didn't have to do that. But yeah, it's a very interesting tradition for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe some of it is just what we're familiar with, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know, maybe Shiva wouldn't be as comforting to someone for whom it was like a brand new concept.
Right. No. Absolutely.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think too, one of the main things that I always communicate when people want to know, how do I show up for someone? I say, just be with them. Like, just one, ask them how do they want to be supported? And then two, mm-hmm. just be willing to just be there, not have the right answers, not have any, you're just presence. Your presence is mm-hmm. is what's needed. So what would you want to say to those who are siblings and have experienced this loss, whether acutely or it's been a while? What would you want them to know today as they're facing that grief?
First and foremost, that their loss matters, mm-hmm. that their grief matters, they're allowed to grieve, that whatever they lost, whether it be a best friend or a very difficult relationship, and now they've lost the opportunity to reconcile or the opportunity to have the sibling they always wanted, the opportunity for a future, whatever it is that you lost, it's significant. It doesn't matter if you were close or not, or whatever the qualifier is, that you're allowed to grieve and that you have to grieve, and that that the loss matters, and that they will learn to exist and they will learn to exist in this new world, and it won't be easy, but that that this is a big thing, and it needs their time and attention, and that it sucks, that nothing nothing will make it nothing will make it better, but you can learn to live with it, and and you can learn to thrive even in the face of it.
Yeah, I love that. And you said your other brother, what's his name?
Sam.
Sam, that y'all are close now.
Mm-hmm.
What does he think of the book?
He was very supportive of the book from the very beginning. He actually, when I first had the idea for interviews, he was like, "You should make it a podcast." And I was like, "No, that seems like a lot to learn. I'm good." But he has been really supportive through all of this, and he has allowed me to reach out to him at all hours of the day with very triggering questions. And you know, to be present for it. And he's just been an open book, which has been really amazing. I think that I've learned a lot from him just through this process. And I think it's been, we've had a lot of like really beautiful conversations that would not have happened if I wasn't writing the book, you know? And so that feels like a gift.
Yeah. Yeah. And what would you say from this process for yourself? What is an area with grief that you feel like you're growing into right now that you might be stretching into? Like, what are you learning about grief? You said 15 years later?
I still get blindsided by it, where I'll feel really off or I'll feel really sad, and I'll say to my husband, like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just feel this, and this, you know. And maybe a few hours later or a few days later, I'll say, like, I think I miss Ben. And it's always like, you know, it'll be around the anniversary of his death or around his birthday or around something, or there will be something that reminds me of him. And for a while, my husband would point it out. My husband would be like, "Do you think maybe you miss Ben? Is that, you know?" And I'd be like, "No, that's not it," you know? And then like, of course it was. And I feel like I am getting more comfortable not being sad without a clear excuse, right? Whereas before I'd be like, "I don't know why I'm sad. It's not October 2nd. It's not, you know, this exact day." So like as if I needed permission to be upset on that specific day. And now I'm like, no, you know what? Like something cute happened with my kids and it made me miss my big brother.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I'm allowed to feel that and be sad. And I think for a long time I would try to like distract myself or try to make myself feel better immediately. And now where I'm kind of stretching and growing is just like allowing myself to be really sad and just sit with it and just be sad. Yeah. And I'll eventually come out of it, but not trying to artificially push my way through, just being sad.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating because we recognize the emotion and we go straight to our head, our brain, and try to justify why we would even feel an emotion if somehow that would bypass it. Like then if I
understand. And then how do I fix it?
Yeah. If I know why, today's October 2nd. Oh, okay. Well, I can be sad today, but let's cut it off after that. But when it's, and there's this real sense of, it sounds like, I'm not trying to be funny, but the daily Shiva, like it's truly a random Shiva. You have a moment of, I just get to be with the sadness and allow it to be. And I love that you said, I will come out of it. I will come out of it. But it's almost like our brain doesn't trust that initially. Yeah. And then you get to see, oh, I did. And then as you see you do, you allow yourself with more grace and compassion the next time to allow it to come up again. That's powerful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I love that. I feel like that will resonates with me. I'm sure it will resonate with a lot of people as well to feel that permission. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on here. I have loved the conversation. I feel like I got relaxed.
Me too. This has been wonderful.
I love it. Okay, so where can people find you?
Yes, they can find me on Instagram at Annie Sclaver Orenstein. And they can find Always a Sibling, The Forgotten Mourner's Guide to Grief, everywhere books are sold.
That is wonderful. I love it. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.